Okay, do we have any visitors in the class before I get started? Want to introduce any visitors who happen to be here? Anyone? First or second time? All right. Okay, well, good to see so many of you back. I'm going to start distributing right now copies of our handout for the last few chapters of the Book of Job, Evidences for Metaphor of Allegory. So if you didn't get one of the 200 copies that have already been distributed, feel free to take one of these. So we could start over here. With that, I want to thank all of you here for your patience and diligence in our study through good chunks of the Book of Job. It actually paid off for me personally quite handsomely this past week because we got a call from a TV production company. They wanted to know if they could come to Reasons to Believe because they're doing a two-hour special on the Book of Job and a few other things. Creation texts in the Bible and the Book of Job. And I said, I think we can accommodate you. And they're only going to stay for about an hour and a half. They wound up staying all day. They talked to me, to Fuzz, as well as to Ken. And they were very pleased with the content they got, and they said they never knew there was so much in the Book of Job. So I want to thank all of you for preparing me for that opportunity. I don't know exactly which network it will show on. It will be a secular network. It will not be a Christian network. It's a secular network. And the host will be Roger Moore. That's the guy who was the... James Bond, right? the first James Bond, I think, right? So, yeah, should be decent. Okay. All right. Although, as Fuzz says, you know, his career must be suffering for him to come from James Bond down to hosting the show. But I don't know whether he's a believer or not. But in the production crew, the fellow asking us the questions was, and his crew members were all non-Christians and had a good time talking to them. Yeah, it was really good. I really appreciated that, but... just shows you how God controls things and the way we go through different portions of Scripture. I want to give you a quick report before we jump into our study of allegory and metaphor in the last few chapters of the Book of Job. This paper was published just a few days ago in the Astrophysical Journal, July 20th edition. They're always about 2 or 3 weeks late. And it's called The Effects of Inhomogeneities and Cosmic Expansion. Sounds exciting, doesn't it? But it was the lead paper in the Astrophysical Journal, and it's significant in the sense that they were able to eliminate a major portion of speculation in an attempt to get around the evidence for supernatural design of the universe. As I said in the class before, the most spectacular scientific evidence we have, and at least in terms of rigorous scientific evidence, for superintelligent, supernatural creator, is the dark energy component of the universe. Now, astronomers have determined that's the dominant component of the universe, but we noted that Job talks about where does darkness reside. Well, we now know that darkness in cosmic form comes in three forms, and dark energy is the most significant of the three forms. And incidentally, it's only been in the past few months that scientists have actually been able to locate where this darkness resides, and that discovery is providing us with these most powerful evidences for a supernatural, superintelligent creator. However, there's been a group of atheist and agnostic astronomers who have suggested that perhaps energy inhomogeneities in the universe may contribute to the acceleration of the universe that's been attributed to the dark energy term, and therefore that dark energy may not play as critical a role as what astronomers believe in expanding the universe and expanding it at the just right rate so you get galaxies, stars, and planets. And so what these two astronomers have done at the University of Florida is to build through supercomputers models of the universe where they throw in a lot of inhomogeneities. Now, that's a term you're not familiar with. As we look at the universe, it appears to a first order to be extremely smooth and even in the distribution of matter and energy. And there are very slight departures from that smoothness and uniformity that lead to the formation of galaxies, stars, and planets. So, I mean, if the universe was perfectly smooth, then all you would get would be dispersed gas for the whole life of the universe. On the other hand, if it was highly inhomogeneous and non-uniform, then all the mass of the universe would be concentrated into giant black holes. You need it to be extremely smooth, but not perfectly smooth. Well, what these astronomers did is to test the effect of throwing in more inhomogeneity than what we think, particularly energy inhomogeneity, and see what effect it has on the expansion of the universe, and if indeed we can reduce the level of design that's apparent in the dark energy term of the universe. And they ran a whole set of models, and they basically said it has no impact. And so this is a major advance. I'll give you a direct quote from the paper. It says, the net effect of the inhomogeneity energy on the expansion rate remains negligible at all times and at all inhomogeneities. In particular, the contribution due to inhomogeneities never mimics the effects of dark energy and never induces any accelerated expansion, which means, bottom line, dark energy really is the principal driving mechanism behind the accelerating universe, the fact that the universe expands more and more rapidly as time goes by, and that indeed we live in a universe where gravity slowed down the expansion of the universe for its first 8 billion years, and has been accelerating the expansion of the universe for the past 5.5 billion years. And therefore, we really are looking at design measures that exceed 1 part in 10 to the 120th. And to put that in context, for those of you who hadn't heard that before, the best example we can give for human engineering design is 1 part in 10 to the 23. So, in showing that dark energy must be fine-tuned to within 1 part in 10 to the 120th, that means we're looking at a creator that's at least 10 to the 97 times more intelligent, more knowledgeable, more creative, and better funded than we human beings. Okay? So, this is significant, and it not only establishes that God is a personal being, but that God is a personal being who is so extremely powerful and creative, intelligent, and knowledgeable, that we're looking at the God of the Bible as opposed to the God of Hinduism, the God of Buddhism, or the distant God of Islam. So we'll be talking about this on our Creation Update webcast this coming Tuesday. Actually, I could put it more strongly. Astronomers for the past 3 years have been trying to find some way to lower the level of apparent design and dark energy, and this is really the last attempt. You know, they've been speculating that maybe different constants of physics are varying in a way that we may not be able to see well, and that's been gradually shown not to be the case. And now this is kind of the last holdup. Maybe there's some exotic inhomogeneities, and these two guys are saying it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how exotic the inhomogeneities are. They aren't going to make any difference in terms of the expansion of the universe. Now, at the same time, in the same issue of the Astrophysical Journal, this paper got published by an old friend of mine, Jacques Vallée. Now, it's not the Jacques Vallée of UFO fame. This is a Jacques Vallée who's built a reputation in examining the structure of our Milky Way galaxy. He and I were graduate students together, shared the same office when we were at the University of Toronto. And he's really devoted his life to looking at the spiral structure of our galaxy. And you say, you know, what's so difficult about that? But as he points out in this paper, it's extraordinarily difficult because we live inside the Milky Way galaxy. It's easy to examine in some detail the structure of other galaxies because we're outside, we get to look at the galaxy and see the whole piece. The problem with trying to figure out the structure of our galaxy is that, you know, we're inside it and our view is blocked by dust lanes that exist in the galaxy. I mean, you look up at the Milky Way in the nighttime sky, not here, but up in the mountains or out in the desert, and, you know, you see this band of faint light that goes across the sky. But that band of faint light is a combination of many different spiral arms of our galaxy, and Jacques has devoted his life to figuring out which of those pieces refer to which spiral arm. In fact, in the latest issue, this is in the issue of the Astronomical Journal, as opposed to the Astrophysical Journal. I got them both on the same day. They're both put out by the same publishing company, University of Chicago. But this also made the front cover. He came up with this beautiful map of the spiral arm structure of the galaxy, and they put it on the front cover of the Astronomical Journal. And as you look at the paper inside, and by the way, Jacques is not a Christian. He's far from it. I've been trying to talk to him for several decades now about... some of it's personal. He was raised in Quebec, and he's French-Canadian, as you can tell by the name. And I had some rather bitter experiences with the Roman Catholic Church growing up, and I think that's a lot of what's stopping him. But in this paper, he is able to establish several new parameters for the spiral arm structure of our galaxy. One is he talks about the unusual number of arms. You know, your typical spiral galaxy is described by two predominant spiral arms that kind of spiral around one another. Our Milky Way galaxy is different. It is many spiral arms. I wish I could remember the exact number. If you get the cover of the Astronomical Journal, you can count them all up. I remember it's on the order of 7 or 8 spiral arms. But what he points out in this paper is that the number of spiral arms in a galaxy is a factor for whether or not you get life in a galaxy. If you have too few spiral arms, the problem is that you're not going to get heavy elements pushed far enough away from the center of the galaxy that you'll have the elements that are necessary for primitive life and advanced life. But if you've got too many spiral arms will be so close to one another that they will either irradiate the planet that's got life on it at the just right distance from the center of the galaxy, or it'll gravitationally disturb it, so it'll get exposed to giant stars and thereby get exposed to nasty radiation. So he says the number of arms is critical. Then he talks about the shape of the arms. You know, whether you're talking, in our Milky Way galaxy is distinct in that it has rather large diameter spiral arms. The spiral arms are kind of like tubes of gas, dust, and bright stars. And ours are on the large size. And again, that has a factor for whether or not life is possible. If the arms are too small or too narrow, then that means you tend to have a lot more stuff per unit area in that arm, which makes those arms more dangerous. By the way, our sun, as it goes around the center of the galaxy, is right now in between two spiral arms. That's the other thing he points out. He talks about the inter-arm separation of the point of the sun, and it's remarkably large. The separation between spiral arms and galaxies can be small or it can be large. In our case, only in the vicinity of the sun is it large. Elsewhere in our galaxy, the separation between the arms tends to be quite close. After all, we're talking 7 or 8 arms. They've got to be close together. But as he points out in this paper, what's remarkable about the solar system, it seems to be at that one place in our galaxy where there's a significant distance between the spiral arms, and we're in between those two spiral arms. And that means that we are safe. By the way, it's not a nice place to be near a spiral arm. The problem with spiral arms is that they're very dense gas clouds and dust clouds there. And when the sun goes through one of what they call molecular dust and gas clouds, which is what we've done before, then you get a particularly persistent and long-lasting and very cold ice age. In fact, as we look at the fossil record, we can determine that there have been events in the past where there has been an unusually long cold period, and astronomers have been able in 4 of those instances to identify them with the solar system passing through one of these dense molecular clouds. But right now, we're nowhere near any of these dense molecular clouds, and it'll be some time before we bump into one of those things in the future. And so there's this window in which the solar system, as its orbit goes around the galaxy, we've been free of the dangers of these dense molecular clouds, and we've been free of the radiation that you get from the spiral galaxy, or for me, the spiral arms. The spiral arms are defined by newborn clusters of stars. And the problem with newborn clusters of stars is that they're filled with what you call supergiant stars, which are very hot. They're blue. I mean, if you look at some of the bright stars you see tonight, you'll notice that the brightest stars tend to be on the bluish or white color side. And those are typical young supergiant stars. And young supergiant stars have a nasty reputation of blasting their environment with ultraviolet and X-ray radiation. So you don't want to be around those. They also have the problem that these young supergiant stars burn up fast, and when they end their life, they go supernova. So, you know, Sirius will be up late tonight, and that's the brightest star in the sky. It's one of these young, hot supergiants, and sometime in the future it will go supernova. And when it does, you can basically kiss the human race goodbye. It's only eight light years away. But fortunately, it's not so massive that it's going to happen right away. It'll take some time. But as Jacques Vallée points out in this paper, just how remarkable it is, we have this wide separation, and we've been in this wide separation zone for some time. But as you read the Bible, what do you see? God waits to the very end to create advanced land mammals in human beings. Those are the creatures that are most significantly impacted by a close encounter with the spiral arm, or by a close encounter with one of these dense molecular clouds. Now, he goes on to point out that in addition to the size of the arm and the shape of the arm and the number of arms, there's the pitch angle. What he means by the pitch angle is the angle that the spiral arms relate to one another. I mean, if you've got a spiral arm structure, depending where you are in the galaxy, there will be a particular angle between one spiral arm and the next spiral arm. And that angle is critical because that tells you how much material flowing into the center of the galaxy gets pushed out into the farther reaches of the galaxy. Did I mention this last week or not, how they discovered a new faint galaxy? Probably not. I talked about it on Creation Update. But in order to sustain the spiral structure of a galaxy, the spiral galaxy has got to eat dwarf galaxies on a fairly regular basis. So when you look out at the spiral galaxies in the universe, they're basically gobbling up little galaxies. And as they eat these little galaxies, what happens is a small dwarf galaxy will be sucked by the gravity of the spiral galaxy into the center of the spiral galaxy. That's where most of the mass of a spiral galaxy is at the center. And so the spiral galaxy tends to get sucked into there, and when it gets sucked in, it gets completely destroyed and mixed, and the gas and the dust that's in that dwarf galaxy gets churned by the dynamics of the center of the galaxy and gets spewed out into the outer part of the galaxy. And the degree to which that stuff is spewed out determines how well the spiral structure is sustained, what kind of instabilities you get in that spiral structure, and how many heavy elements you get thrown out to a fairly distant place there. And as he points out, Jacques Vallée points out, the pitch angle is critical for how efficiently this stuff gets spit from the center of the galaxy into the outer parts of the galaxy. And if you don't spit enough stuff out, then the spiral structure begins to develop spurs and bumps, which would be bad for life on planet Earth. So you got to be careful how much you throw out there. But if you don't throw it enough, then the spiral structure is not sustained at all, and the whole thing will collapse into a spherical galaxy. Yes. There's a density wave resonance that sustains the spiral arms, but that density wave resonance requires a continual injection of dwarf galaxies into the center of the galaxy to keep it. When we astronomers do models of spiral galaxies, what you discover is that the spiral arm structure will disappear fast unless you keep putting in more gas and dust into the center. Now, here's an elegant experiment you can do. Get a cup of a fairly dense coffee, okay? Not American-style coffee, but you want to make it really strong. And then you get this cream, and what you want is cream that's at least 20% butterfat. Don't get the stuff that Well, I won't. Okay. And then what you do is you drop the cream into this cup, and then you get a spoon and you spin it like this. And what you'll notice is you'll develop a spiral structure just like a spiral galaxy. It looks kind of pretty. Okay. However, if you take your spoon out, what you notice is that the spiral structure fairly quickly collapses. After 3 or 4 rotations, it's gone. And incidentally, that's exactly what happens with a spiral galaxy, is that if you leave it completely alone, the spiral structure disappears in 3 or 4 rotations. Now, something else you can do is a cup of coffee. Okay, you're stirring the coffee, okay, and you see the spiral structure set up. If you continue to drop cream in at a very slow rate, it sustains the spiral structure a lot longer. So you can do galaxy models right in the kitchen. So, and actually it was Alan Sandage and a few astronomers who did these experiments with coffee and cream back in the 40s that led them to build these models for galaxies, which a little more sophisticated than the coffee and the cream, but it's really what led to studies like this one by Jacques Vallée, what it takes to keep the spiral structure going. So does that help? Well, astronomers for a long time have been trying to figure out, I mean, the thing about the spiral galaxies is that the spiral structure does not revolve or rotate at the same rate that the stars revolve around the center of the galaxy, unless the star is right at the co-rotation distance. By the way, it's one of the reasons why our solar system has stayed in between two spiral arms for so long. We happen to be very near that distance where a star goes around the center of the galaxy at exactly the same rate that the spiral structure rotates. Now, astronomers have been trying to figure out why the spiral structure has this distinct rotation feature. I mean, the whole structure seems to rotate at one rate, whereas the stars rotate at or revolve around the center at different rates. And this is where they came up with this density wave theory. And it's basically a gravitational theory. And it's just like what I said, what sustains everything is you keep putting mass in at a slow rate into the center of the galaxy, and it will produce this gravitational phenomena that will sustain the spiral structure. So that's what they mean by the density wave. It's kind of a calculation of how the density of mass is distributed along the spiral arm. You actually get a higher density in one side of the spiral arm than you do the other side of the spiral arm, and that is sustained by this continual feeding. Now, if you feed too much into the center of the galaxy or at a too quick of a rate, what happens is the galaxy forms a bar, and there's this huge episode of star formation everywhere over the spiral arms, because the problem is you're throwing in so much dust and gas at such a high rate, it fuels a whole bunch of stuff out through the density waves into the spiral arms and causes star formation to ignite everywhere. We refer to these as starburst galaxies. And the problem with a starburst galaxy, yeah, we come up with the appropriate name, just like they call our group of galaxies the local group. I mean, you wonder where they come up with all these creative names. Yeah, where was I? I was talking about what now? Starburst galaxies. Yeah, if you're in a starburst galaxy, that means you got giant stars forming everywhere, blasting the entire galaxy with radiation, and life is not possible there. On the other hand, if you don't have enough gas and dust coming in, you won't have the spiral structure, and that too is inappropriate for life. You say, why do you need the spiral structure? Okay. Go back to your coffee analogy, okay? You're pouring cream into the cup and you're stirring it. And what you notice, if you don't keep pouring cream into it, is that the spiral structure will basically collapse into this kind of globular goop, okay? And again, you got to use very heavy cream because the heavy stuff will go towards the center of all the spinning. And the problem with that is it jams all the stars really close together. And when you look at an elliptical galaxy, that's what you're looking at. A giant elliptical galaxy is a collapsed spiral galaxy, where the spiral structure collapses, the whole galaxy condenses, stars are now very close together, And the problem with that is if you got a star close to a solar system or a planetary system, that nearby star will disturb the orbits of the planets going around that star. So life is not possible in any kind of galaxy except a spiral galaxy. And that eliminates right there 94% of all the galaxies in the universe. Only 6% are spirals. Sometimes you get deceived because they show you all these galaxies on TV. Well, of course, they show you the pretty ones. The problem with the spherical galaxies, they don't look very like much at all. I mean, all you got is just a big ball of light. So it doesn't look very interesting, so they don't show you. But those are the dominant galaxies in the universe. You know, 94% of the galaxies are like that, or the dwarf galaxies. And so maintaining the spiral structure is critical for life, but you've got to be careful exactly what that spiral structure looks like. And that's the point of Jacques Vallée's paper, is that there's literally dozens of different characteristics of the spiral arms that must be fine-tuned to at least sustain advanced life. You know, bacteria are not so critical. Like if you're talking advanced life, birds, mammals, and human beings, then you have to be very careful about the different characteristics of the spiral arms, and it is temporary. In our own particular galaxy, it's not going to be that much longer before these conditions that are so benign will be disturbed. In fact, we can document that over the past half billion years, the solar system has crossed a spiral arm four times. And when it goes through a spiral arm, it wipes out all the advanced life. So we're coming up on another crossing in the fairly near future, which means the next few hundred million years. So, but, you know, when people ask you the question, why does the fossil record look the way it does? And people say, well, it's got to be evolution. No, it's a God that knows exactly the future physics of the sun and the galaxy and planet Earth and creates just the right life forms that would be appropriate for the conditions that exist at that time. So it explains why there's been these episodes we see in the fossil record where you see a real collapse of advanced life and then a recovery that takes place thereafter, yes. That probability is relatively small. The stars are really far apart. And so, for example, you can have two giant spiral galaxies collide with one another, head-on collision, with no collisions between the stars. You know, that can happen. And that's because although the galaxies are close together in the sky, I mean, if I were to give you a model for what the universe looks like, the typical separation between two galaxies, if a galaxy were the size of my fist, the next nearest galaxy would be about here. So they're relatively close together, and therefore galaxy collisions take place quite frequently. If I wanted to, I could show you all kinds of photographs of galaxies that are in the process of colliding. However, if my fists were a typical star, on the average for the universe, and pardon me, just for a galaxy, the universe is much more extreme, but in terms of our galaxy, the next nearest star would not be here. It would be somewhere in Siberia or Peru. Okay, so that's why two galaxies can have a head-on collision and none of the stars hit, or only a few of the stars hit. And so if we were to pass through a spiral arm, it's highly unlikely that any star would hit the sun or any of the planets. On the other hand, it's quite probable that in going through a spiral arm, the stars there would significantly disturb the orbits of the planets. And if that were to happen, that would ruin the possibility for life on planet Earth. So you say, well, what happened in the other encounters? Well, fortunately, we're far enough away from the center of the galaxy that in previous... We can't exactly figure out exactly how the solar system passed through the spiral arms, but it must have passed through regions of the spiral arms where the star density was not that intense. However, there's no doubt that there was an encounter with radiation and an encounter with dense molecular clouds. And that radiation in those clouds would be devastating for at least the advanced life forms. Okay. Can we get into the book of Job now? No, I guess not. Okay. Go ahead, Bertrand.
One
Well, that's true. The average density of the universe is about one proton per cubic meter. So it's not very dense at all. However, you can get a more accurate determination of the number of protons and neutrons in the universe by asking the question, what density do you need to have human life existing at this point of time? And that actually gives you a much accurate measure than simply looking out into the universe and determining what the how much mass there is per unit volume. You can definitely say that. Yeah. So the universe is mostly empty. I mean, what you stated is correct. It's empty to the degree that the average density is about one proton per cubic meter. And so, yeah, it's mostly empty space. And by the way, the degree of emptiness is critical for whether or not you get life. If we're any more empty or less empty, there'd be no life. In fact, that must be tuned to within one part in a quadrillion, 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 quadrillion. So, I mean, if you had one proton for every 1.001 cubic meters instead of 1.0, you'd have a problem. Now, keep in mind, when we say it's one per cubic meter, that's approximate. We can't make the measurements that accurately. But theoretically, we can say, what do we need to have human life possible? And although we can't come up with an absolute number, we can come up with a number that we know must be incredibly fine-tuned. And it's approximately one proton per cubic meter. Yes. I don't know a lot about the story. What I'm trying to remember is where they got the funding. But Harvard University wound up with a lot of money for studying the origin of life, and they're trying to figure out what to do with it. Okay, that happens to some institutions where they get a whole bunch of money and they say, what are we going to do with all this money? So, I don't know if that's ever happened to you personally, but, there's two possible sources. Number one, they got a private bequest, which I'm thinking that's what was going on here. Number two, they got a fairly decent grant from NASA. NASA is the number one funder of origin of life research today by a huge margin. But there are also wealthy individuals who are motivated to try to fund this research. Almost all other sources of funding are drying up. And the reason why they're drying up, traditional sources, is origin of life research has been basically bankrupt for 50 years. For 50 years, they've been trying to find a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life, and they've come up with nothing to suggest how that could happen. So the NSF is pretty well giving up on it, but NASA's not. They're pouring all kinds of money into it, mainly because they recognize that maybe the public, if they get excited about the origin of life, will get excited about funding NASA. Because one of the things that the past 50 years has done is to prove there in a very definitive way the origin of life cannot possibly happen naturalistically on planet Earth. And therefore, NASA's excited about funding origin of life research. Since we've already ruled out planet Earth, what does that leave you with? The stuff that NASA does. So, naturally. Like send another mission to Mars, whatever. So, now exactly what Harvard's going to do with all this money, I don't know. The last I heard of it is they're trying to figure out what to do with all the money. And one of the problems is you don't want to throw the money at stuff that we've already shown is not going to produce results. Well, Fuzz and I have been attending these Origin of Life research conferences, and yes, that's very clear at these Origin of Life research conferences is that they do not want to pursue the God option. They're only interested in pursuing naturalistic explanations, although there is now quite a bit of interest in pursuing what they call directed panspermia. That since the naturalistic answers aren't working very well, there's got to be this intelligent civilization on planet Zorox that sends spaceships here on a regular basis to plant life here on planet Earth. So, well, that's the whole problem. I mean, if you're going to blame it on the Zoroxians, where do they come from? And, you know, and my critique is we know they can't send spaceships here. So we're looking at distances. Because one thing that the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life has done is to show definitively if there's intelligent life out there, it's not close by. And if it's not close by, we're looking at a very long space trip. And the problem with a very long space trip is any life on board will die by the time it gets to the desired location. So on that basis alone, we can rule out directed panspermia. But as Fuzz and I were trying to point out to some of the researchers at the Origin of Life conferences, how about supernatural directed panspermia? Why not a god that transcends space and time doing all that? That is an option that at this point they're not prepared to pursue. And when Fuzz and I asked these people directly, by the way, if you're interested, we've interviewed some of the atheist Origin of Life researchers on a Creation Update webcast, and they're archived on our website. You can hear what they say. But I'll tell you what they say. They say, that is the last option we're going to look at. We're not going to look at the God option until we've ruled out everything that we can possibly rule out that's an alternative to that. The problem with that line of thinking is that means you will never consider the God option until you know everything about the universe. And that'll never happen. So what you really need to do is kind of say, well, let's look at the God option in contrast with the non-God option and see where the evidence is stronger. But there's a real reluctance for them to do that. Well, we interviewed the atheist Origin of Life researcher Robert Shapiro on our show. And he is got a nickname that's been pinned on him by the rest of the Origin of Life research community, and the nickname is Dr. No. And he's called Dr. No because every time somebody comes up with an idea to explain the origin of life, he's able to get up and brilliantly explain why it won't work. And so he's able to say no to everything. And his whole point is, the fact that we can say no to everything, doesn't that tell us something about origin of life research? And we say, yeah, you're onto something, Robert, but he doesn't want to go there. So it's like he partly sees what we're doing and the value of it, but he says personally, now I think part of it again is background. Just as I mentioned about Jacques Vallée, Roman Catholic upbringing, Robert Shapiro's a Jew. And, we tried to ask him questions about his Judaism. Doesn't want to go there. The fact that he doesn't want to go there tells me there's something going on there. So, but hey, that's the way it is with all of us, right? There's baggage we all carry that prevents us from really discerning the truth, which should get us into the book of Job, okay? All right. I needed a segue here somewhere to get us going. Nice transition. Well, it's a nice transition, too. And that what we're noticing in this heavy use of metaphor and allegory, starting in Job 38 and going on to Job 39 and 40 and 41, is that this allegory and metaphor and simile is used to get through human resistance to what's taking place. And, we've been talking about it. Here are these astrophysicists and Origin of Life researchers that are resistant for different reasons, and therefore God speaks not in a straight literal fashion. He speaks through metaphor, and he speaks through allegory. But I notice we got Wes back in the class. So this is Wes's last Sunday. He's heading for Uganda, where he'll be working with several Sudanese and developing a new translation. He'd like to say goodbye. The way I just asked him a question, when is he going to be back with us? He says it'll be 2.5 to 3 years. So this is goodbye for a little while. So I know he wants to come up and say a special goodbye to all of you. And Wes, we've appreciated your teaching in this class. And I've also asked Wes if he'd be willing to field some last questions from you before he takes off. So Wes.
Trying to see if I can get through this day without without tears. I probably won't, but I've really enjoyed the 10 years I've been here. It's been really good. And looking forward to going. I really want to get through the next few days when I get done all the things that finally need to be done so I can actually physically leave Southern California. But we're having the commissioning service for me right after the paradoxes, so don't linger here. Please come over. It will just be about 20 minutes, but I really want you to be there and your handshakes and hugs afterwards and prayer and all. So, any questions you have? Take a couple and then let you get back to what you're all doing.
So, when are you getting on the plane?
September 3rd, 6:30 in the evening from Atlanta. Arriving in London at 7:30 or so in the morning, with a little bit of a time difference there. And then I get to do something wonderful in London for 12 hours. Well, I'm switching airports from Gatwick to Heathrow. And although I trust that my bags will be switched for me, because I'm taking 3 70-pound bags. That's everything I can take with me, 3 70-pound bags. And then in the evening of the 4th, I get on the plane again for Uganda nonstop and arrive at something like 5:30 or so in the morning. Again, so it's a 10-hour time difference between California time and Ugandan time. So when you're getting up for your day, I'm getting done with mine. Yes. A specific goal? I don't know a specific goal. It has to do with other furlough times and having the bases covered, you know. So there are other people who will be in furlough. The translation coordinator that's going to be training me is having furlough right now, and I'm going to be... I get to Uganda, and I'm there 3 days. Some of you have seen the house I may be renting. It's a brand new modern. You won't grieve for me too much. Tile roof and brick facade and modern windows. A pedestal sink in the bathroom. Tile on the walls. I was a little bit blown away. It was not what in my mind. It was described to me, and I had this vision. And then they sent me pictures and couldn't quite believe it.
So bathroom inside.
Bathroom's inside. Yes. tile bathroom. Behind, this is a Ugandan family who owns both houses. The front house is probably 4,000 to 5,000 square foot with a satellite to dish outside. So the modern world has reached Uganda. But then I will be there in Uganda just for 3 days. And on the 8th, I'll get on Kenya Airlines. You can pray for me then. Flying from Entebbe to Nairobi, and then from Nairobi to Yaoundé, Cameroon. And then I will have an orientation course. All the new members of Wycliffe do an orientation course, and it lasts through the 25th of November. And then I come back to Uganda, and I may have already rented that house and have some stuff there. And then I will begin learning not Ugandan, Lugandan, and beginning to be trained to do what I'm going to do, which is to be I will ultimately be trained to become a translation consultant. So I'm going to be the intermediator between the mother tongue translators and the Greek text, helping them with issues of meaning to bring that over into their translation. And there are 8 translation projects of languages from Sudan that are going on right now in Entebbe. And although they've not done Romans or Hebrews, which is two of my favorite books, so that'll be fun to have a part in that. And they need someone to teach Greek, so I will really enjoy doing that. And I don't know all the other duties that will befall me. Probably I'll get my paint. Yes, yeah. I finally got PowerPoint presentations on the translation projects, and it's clear that the 8 are working together book by book through the New Testament, and some of these projects have the New Testament completed and they're beginning Old Testament work. And in fact, all of them seem to have, like, Genesis has been translated, so they're working in both Testaments. And there are various professors that will come to do workshops, the facility, the translation consultant, to be working in the same place at the same time. Yeah. Anything else? Well, I had an estate sale yesterday. Did pretty well, but I still have a washer and dryer and refrigerator and sofa and some large items that need to get carted away. So if any of you need any of those things, call me. Come and see. I should be home between 3 and 6 this afternoon. or the Salvation Army or the churches rummage here, someone's going to get it. So painting I wanted to do. David's going to help me a few days this week. If any one of you has a truck and some time just to maybe take stuff to dump or take stuff, whatever, call me. That would be appreciated. Or just some hands to carry boxes here and there. And I have a storage set I built in my garage, and praise God, my train table got sold. Although it's sitting outside of my garage, I told the guy, you need a truck with a lift bed, and he didn't believe me, and he came with another fellow, and they couldn't get it on their truck yesterday, and so I put some 2x4x12s underneath the train table to help them, giving them a place to lift. You just can't lift anywhere on a train table. And I hope when I get home today it's gone. I've been paid anyway. So I have things that have to get to the storage shed. Just you have to go through stuff to throw out and figure out you don't want to save everything in the storage box. And I cooked on my camp, my frying pans, everything got sold, but I did have my camp frying pan, so I made an omelet and fried potatoes today. I wanted to do that today, and I thought no one would want these frying pans, surely, and I looked in there and they were gone, so... Oh, well, what's out there still in the yard? So anyway. Places got rented on Thursday. My truck got sold yesterday. They're going to pick it up on Wednesday. I still have an airless sprayer I would like to sell after Wednesday. I'll be using it for a few days this week. So, yeah. I am fully funded. However, the continual goal or need is to keep that maintained, and over time there will be attrition, natural attrition for various circumstances. And so if God has not yet placed it on your heart to support me, there may come a time when God will, for those that have been supporting me, either one-time giftings or in a continual monthly or quarterly gifting. I'm very grateful, and very, very grateful to the church, which is providing half of my support, and a very large one-time gift, which has been very, very, very wonderful. So, yes, that's been good. Tricky about whether my taxes, I have enough money to pay my taxes for this year. You know, those are always, being in business, some of those practical things, no one's taking that money out. So I trust that I'll have my taxes covered when that's due. You know? But yeah, that's been pretty well cared for. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you. Thank you. Oh, yes. And if you've gotten my newsletters, it's on the internet. Thing is there. And there will be my summer newsletter will be there at the commissioning service. And also, if people are not yet on getting my newsletter, you should have gotten two if you're on my mailing list. If you have not gotten them, there's a response card. Or if you would like to support me, there will be some response cards there at the table, at the commissioning, and my prayer letter, which has my email address. You can be in touch with me anywhere around the world with that. So thank you.
And if you forget his mailing address or his email address, you can contact the church. They have it on file. So if you don't have a computer and want to use snail mail, you can do that. Right. And don't send them perishable foods by snail mail. They may not make it there. Send them by email. There you go. All right. Who else is ready? Wow, look at that show of hands. This is exciting. You know, I got ways to motivate you, but I don't want to resort to that. So... Okay, how many of you know what group you're in? Wow, another great show of hands. No. Okay. Okay. Can I see those hands again? Okay. If you know what group you're in, you're ready to report. All right. We got volunteers. So which one wants to be first? Okay. We got a couple here. Got a gentleman over here. I've got John over there. All right. Don't all rush up here at once. And hey, I know at least half of you are ready. You've been working on this a long time, so. And, you know, after all, Mark gave you a good example. I'm not asking for something difficult. Just a few minutes here, nail it down one at a time. Pick a metaphor. Let's go. Okay. Who wants to jump up first? Who wants me to assign somebody to jump up first? You really don't need me. Okay, it looks like you're volunteering. All right.
Both of you. Okay. Can you hear me better if I use the microphone? Oh, that's terrible. I got a loud voice. All right. If someone did already, verses 4 through 6 or 7, I'm going to do verse 8. Okay? Because this thing is just packed with metaphors. Okay. Who enclosed the sea with doors? Now, how many of you have been to the seashore and seen doors? I haven't seen any doors at the seashore. What you see at the seashore is this vast expanse of water. Huh? And even in the Mediterranean, you know, where they might be, you see this vast expanse of water. So it's obvious we're doing a metaphor here. Enclose the sea with doors. Why would he speak of doors? Well, obviously doors are used to close off rooms.
Doors are used
to close off things. So he's using a metaphor here which describes how you limit the extent of the sea. He has limited the extent of the sea, otherwise we could not live, right? So he's enclosed the sea with doors. That's a very strong metaphor that he uses. When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. Whoa! It went out from the womb? Another metaphor. We're still in the same verse, right? We've still got two metaphors in that one verse. Went out from the womb. What on earth does that talk about? Well, if you think about it, they're used to birth. You know, there are people, they're used to childbirth. They know that something new comes forth. God brought something new forth. And he describes that not in terms of condensation coming from the heavens, which they wouldn't understand, but he describes it in terms of bursting forth from a womb, because they all knew about wombs and how new life comes from a womb. And we know from listening to Hugh that there's lots of new life that comes from the sea. So there's two powerful metaphors right there.
Zero preparation, but now we get to the tough question. Why in verse 8 is it using these metaphors?
Well, it's talking about something we know about.
Right. Okay, why these particular metaphors? I mean, as you mentioned here, there's all kinds of different ways God could do it. Why did he pick this way to do it? And what point of resistance is he trying to get through? Yeah. Yeah, there have been events like that, but not in human history. So this is not something that Job and his colleagues have been aware of. We're aware of it. And, you know, that's a good point. Maybe these metaphors are not just for Job and his friends. Maybe they're for us. In fact, we said that explicitly in a class, that this is a text that's communicating to many generations at once. And therefore, that might help explain why we have the kind of metaphors in the text that we do. Okay, but you know what we've talked about? Yeah, go ahead. Right. You know, in helping the audiences see the degree of power here. So, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about. You know, God speaks in this way when he's trying to get through a difficult point or a point where the audience is resisting because of some sin within them or some pride within them. Yes, Wes? Good. We got somebody who's prepared. All right.
In verse 16, it says, "Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked into the recesses of the deep?" And we considered that this was a dynamic metaphor that At that time, they wouldn't know about deep sea vents, but we know about those today. And so it was more metaphorical for them to understand the workings of God at that time, and now we know it more scientifically. And so as our knowledge advances, we see both the poetry and the science, where then the poetry substituted for the science but gave them an inkling of the science, and so that it would give them an awe of God and what he had to do, what he has done. And so I was just thinking that this would give a reflection on the doors.
Now, when you put it in the context of what's happened in the past 37 chapters, when we get here, God, through the use of these metaphors, is getting across is, you've been debating for 37 chapters how great and majestic I am, but you're really not getting it. I'm far more majestic and powerful than you've been able to discern. And then he poses these questions and uses these metaphors. I like the idea, you know, putting up doors. How many doors would it take to do what God has done with the continents? It gives you some appreciation for what's going on there. But, you know, in terms of modern science, we realize that having a planet with vast oceans and huge continents is utterly amazing. And yet, Job and his colleagues are taking that all for granted. No, this is the way things are. And God says, no, have you considered? And through the use of the metaphors, you get some thinking along these lines. John? Well, something that geophysicists have pondered just in the last few years is how come Earth has so little water? Now, we look at planet Earth as a water planet, but if you actually look at how much water is on our planet, I forget the exact number, but I think it's like 0.02% water. The rest of it is not water. And yet water is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. Now, given the way our planet Earth would normally form, it should be drenched in water. And if it's drenched in water, that means there's no doors. So the fact that it has doors at all, the fact that the water is so limited and can be controlled by doors, is itself miraculous. By the way, if you want to read up more on that, there's a book over there written by an atheist and an agnostic called Rare Earth. That's one of the things they comment on, is just how miraculous it is that planet Earth has so little water. But if it didn't have so little water, there'd be no continental land masses, and without continental land masses, there's no way you could have a physical, intelligent civilization. They actually speculate in the book, could the porpoises pull off an advanced civilization? Well, if you're in a water environment, there's a lot of limitations upon what you could do, even if you were super intelligent. The land masses are critical. And the land masses are particularly critical to have more than the narrowest window for the existence of life. It's the doors themselves which enable God to create life and remove life from planet Earth in such a way that you can have life on the planet for billions of years. If it wasn't for a planet with substantial continents and oceans coexisting with one another, there'd be no way to compensate for the increase in the luminosity of the sun. That takes that to make it happen. All that's in the book, Rare Earth. Yes. Okay. What he has done, which is what I was really wanting to lead to next, next being several weeks from now, is we go through all these metaphors here, and then you go back into the previous 37 chapters. And you know, you did it brilliantly. You know, here's Job talking about how he came out of the womb. And what metaphors did Job use back there? He talked about darkness. He talked about the doors. He talked about the rushing forth. What do we got in these two verses? We got the doors. We got the womb. And then if you read the next verse, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it. Job complains about the limits that have been placed on him. You go back to chapters 3 and 4. And so what God is doing here is just actually taking the same metaphors that these men are using in their arguments and putting it in appropriate context. So, you know, metaphor. And by the way, don't parents do that with their kids? Our kids use metaphors in complaining about the discipline. Sometimes it's effective just to feed back those metaphors in a little different context, the way you get around the points of resistance. I look at God as the perfect parent, and that's what he's doing with these five men here. And we're not off the hook. He's also speaking to us. I mean, we can look at this and say, you know, how often have we done what Job has done back in chapter 3, and is God saying something to us here? But in addition to all that, God is really getting across the message book. You think you know what creation's all about. You think you understand the power and the majesty behind it. You're not even getting close. And so these metaphors are cutting many different ways. Now, in the question I asked you, why does God select the kind of metaphor he does? Because typically he's trying to do several things at once with a metaphor. And so thank you for your discussion. That's really right on. And by the way, he just kind of picked it up at chapter 3. One thing you can do is you go from chapter 3 through to chapter 37 and pick up all the metaphors these men are using in their dialogue with one another and the complaints to one another. It's almost like it's ordered relative to Job 38, 39, and 40, and 41. So what you're seeing here in these first few verses are metaphors you pick up in the early part of the book of Job. What you're going to see in 40 and 41 are metaphors that are towards the latter part. 42 focuses on the very last discussion that Elihu is giving. So now it's not, you know, strict chronology. It does go back and forth, but there is that tendency. You see that here. So thank you for introducing that. That was very good. By the way, our time is gone. And incidentally, I'm not expecting, I mean, we've had some good examples here in the class. One thing I want to emphasize is, in order not to completely terrify you in coming up here at the microphone, our standards are relatively low, okay? You don't have to be as brilliant as our friend over there. And you set a good example. Look, I'm coming to the microphone with zero preparation. I mean, the basics are obvious. And that's really what I want to draw from you, you know, share with us some of the basics that you see in the text. Hey, if you want to go full bore on this, that's fine, but that's not expected. So I just want every one of you, by the way, who is not in a group? Probably half of you are not in a group, okay? Okay. You've got the sheets. I assume there's enough sheets to get around to everybody. I'll print another 50 next week, so... I won't be here next week, but the week after that, and we'll go for it. So, but those of you who have been studying and preparing, I want you to take the lead. Don't push those who are just kind of new into this. But all of you, take this little sheet here, and once again, I'll give you the questions. Pick a metaphor to Job 38. Explain what the metaphor is. Show how the metaphor is indeed a metaphor. What kind of metaphor it is, why the text uses the metaphor instead of just giving a straight literal description of what's going on, and then why does the text use a specific kind of metaphor that it does. And in terms of that one, usually the answer is going to be because God's trying to do more than one thing with more than one audience, which is why he's careful about the kind of metaphor. And as some of you have pointed out here, isn't it interesting how almost every verse is using more than one metaphor? And I'll try to bring that out for us. Okay. Could I repeat those once more? Pick a metaphor out of Job 38. And by the way, I'll try to type this up for you next time. I was going to do that this morning. Couldn't get quite to it. Okay. Pick a metaphor to Job 38. Any metaphor, or allegory, or simile, or figure of speech. I'm using the word metaphor in a very broad sense. How can you show that that metaphor or figure of speech is indeed a metaphor or figure of speech? Why is the text using this, you know, allegory or simile or metaphor instead of just giving us a straight literal sense of what God's trying to communicate? And this sheet will help you on that one. Then why does the text use the specific kind of metaphor that it does? Okay, do I need to repeat that again, or do you all have it? It is. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had, talking about some of the very latest scientific discoveries, and Lord, just how exciting it is that we live in a day and an age where every day there's stronger evidences for your existence and your love and your power and care for us than there was the day before. Father, I pray that you would help us find opportunities to use these as bridges to talk to people about spiritual truth and to expose them about the God that rules over our lives. May we ourselves submit more fully to your control over us. And Father, I pray that you would give us rich times in this book of Job as we prepare for the classes in the next week, 2, 3, 4 weeks. In Jesus' name, amen.